The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing.
Good evening, everybody. Welcome to our Tuesday evening Space Show program. And I am your host, David Livingston. Thank you very much for tuning in. We have one of our favorite guests on tonight, and we're glad to have Dr. Johnson back. I'll introduce him again in just a minute. He's been away and absent from us for a while, but we're truly, truly happy to have him back. First, a couple of quick announcements. We're planning a 60-minute format. So, again, pay attention to the clock. If we go over with your phone calls or your emails, we'll certainly do that. And but do plan 60 minutes. And let's see, Hotel Mars, we're featuring Solar Cycle 25 tomorrow. And we have one of our solar sunspot guests on who's been on Hotel Mars before. And that website will be modified to reflect that information shortly after tonight's program. And then we have Friday and Sunday Space Show programs. As usual, we're back to our regular schedule. And if you would like to call us tonight, and we hope you do, because remember, we prefer phone calls for a talk show rather than emails, it is 1-866-687-7223. But yes, you can continue to email us, Dr. Space, DRSPACE, at thespaceshow.com. Our website newsletter is up on the upper right side of our homepage. It is totally current. Make sure you scroll down. You can see a lot of the programs we're planning between now and the end of the year. And we're filling that schedule up actually very rapidly. I'm a little surprised at how fast things keep moving year to year, especially this year, which is beyond weird. And everything you know, we do on our program is archived, so you can listen right off of our website, or you can listen off of the different media sites that we have if you're listening to podcasts, or you can download the programs very quickly. They're not large file size. Even a 90-minute show is a small file size. And then, you know, if you want the newsletter, our short email newsletter goes out 6 a.m. Monday morning California time. I need your email to send it to you. So if you want to get it, make sure I have your email address. And then the website newsletter is published over the weekend, and upcoming shows menu is also finished out over the weekend for the coming week. So we also have a store, and you can see that by clicking on any of the pictures of Pepper listening to the Space Show, and you might find some logo wear there that is of interest to you. The upper left menu has Listen Live. This is a very important button. Tells you how to listen to the live broadcast like we're doing now. MP3 compressed audios for our website archives, and also podcast. And we're available for almost all the clients for either the Android format or the Apple format. If you have problems, questions, need troubleshooting help, please email me at drspace, D-R-S-P-A-C-E, at thespaceshow.com. Do remember that we are a 501c3 nonprofit with the one, O-N-E, GiantLeapFoundation.org. We're listener-supported, which means that listeners just like you make the content of this show, like we have tonight with Dr. Les Johnson, available. And without your great support and listeners just like you, the Space Show would not exist. So as a 501c3 nonprofit, if you're a federal U.S. taxpayer, you do get a tax deduction for your gift. And the same is true if you're a California taxpayer. We have a big PayPal link button at the top of our homepage. That is the easiest way to support us. But if you do want to use the mail and a check, please make your check payable to 1ONE Giant Leap Foundation. Mails to Post Office Box 95, Tiburon, California, 94920. And again, it is your support that is crucial for us. Remember, we do have sponsors, and those sponsors get our banner ad, get their banner ads going across the homepage. On the shorter formats tonight, I shout out our sponsors for their great support: Northrop Grumman, the Space Foundation, Astrox, AIAA, Moonwords, Celestis, the National Space Society, and the Space Plan. And we really appreciate their support. Click on their banners from time to time and see what their message is underneath the banner ad. And if you, too, are interested in a sponsorship, email me, please, at drspace@thespaceshow.com. Our guest, as I said a few minutes ago, is Dr. Les Johnson. Les is a physicist, author, a NASA technologist. You can read his full bio, which is impressive, and it is already up on the Space Show website. He has a novel out that came out in 2018, Mission to Methone. But his new book, which we're going to talk about tonight, is an edited book, meaning he's got stories in it by great, great people, many of whom you will be familiar with. Stellaris, I probably am pronouncing that wrong, Stellaris, People of the Stars, and more about that in just a minute. But as I said, he's a physicist. He is a real, honest-to-God scientist in addition to an author. So he is an authority and an expert on solar sail missions, and he's got a couple of them. One is the 2014 Solar Cruiser, also he's got Scout, the near-Earth asteroid Scout, which is maybe going to be a follow-on to that older mission. And he says they're on the brink of making solar sail propulsion viable and commonplace. And then in parentheses, in big letters, he goes, yay. So Les, welcome to the Space Show. Yay, you're back with us. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thanks for having me back, David.
If solar sail propulsion is so great, why has it taken so long?
Wow, that's a good question. And the first thing I need to say is kind of the obligatory disclaimer. Although I do work for NASA, any opinion I give is purely my own. I don't represent my employer. I heard you had your own caveat in your disclaimer at the beginning of your show that said that the opinions were your guests, not yours. Well, this is my opinion for sure, because I don't want to reflect my employer. Why has it taken so long? Any new technology really takes time. You have to get the development phase. You have to do all you can on the ground before you go to flight, because it's really expensive to go to flight. And once you go to flight, you have to knock down the risks that the people who want to use it don't want to have to take, right? If you're a scientist and you want to use a solar sail to send a mission somewhere, you want somebody else to take the risk of having the first flight. I guess it's sort of like you and I were talking pre-show about who's going to get the coronavirus vaccine first, right?
Yeah.
Well, scientists are kind of the same. They don't want to risk their payload on an unproven propulsion system. The neat thing is there have been a lot of flights of solar sails lately in Earth orbit and one in interplanetary space, and now missions are ready to take that risk. And the one that's going to fly next year, called Near-Earth Asteroid Scout, is one such mission. It's a science mission that'll use a sail to actually go do science.
So these are NASA and government missions. If the private sector, and only the private sector, were doing solar sails or doing the new technology, would it happen faster? I mean, would they get rid of the risk and retire the risk faster? Do you think it would be measurably faster?
They've helped. And in fact, and this is one area where the private sector has contributed. The Planetary Society flew the Light Sail 1 and Light Sail 2. The Light Sail 2 is actually still in orbit. Those are loosely based on the design of the Nanosail D that we flew back in 2010, which was on a small CubeSat, a 3U CubeSat. That's the 10 by 20 by 30 centimeter little small spacecraft. We deployed a 10 square meter sail. The Planetary Society came in and looked at our design and improved on it, and they tested and flown successfully two 32-square-meter solar sails. And there's no question that they've helped advance the technology. So, yeah, absolutely. The thing about the private sector, and we work with private sector companies all the time, Near Earth Asteroid Scout, we may have designed it, but a company called Nexsol built the fabric and the booms that we use to deploy it. And on the Solar Cruiser, you had to, I think the dates got kind of flopped. Maybe I didn't have it correct in my bio I sent you. The Solar Cruiser, if it flies, will be in 2024. And it'll be the follow-on Aeneas Scout. And it, too, will involve private industry. We'll be working with Ball Aerospace, as well as a company in Colorado called Rocor, as well as Nexsol. So there's a lot of private industry involved in what we do.
What is the best that solar sail propulsion could offer us? Where would the biggest difference be, and is it applicable for human spaceflight?
Okay, I'll answer the second one first. Not yet, and we're a long, long, long way away from solar sails being applicable to human spaceflight. The best way to think about a solar sail, for those in your audience that might not be too familiar, a solar sail is a big, lightweight reflector. Think of a sail on a sailing ship, but instead of reflecting wind to get thrust, it reflects sunlight. And that means the sun has to reflect from it, and sunlight has a very, very low thrust, very, very small. So in order to get a measurable thrust that's useful, your sailcraft has to be really lightweight, and your sail has to be really big area. So the modern solar sails that people are flying are on the order of the thickness of a human hair, and they're made of a plastic that's covered with aluminum, so it's reflective. And that lets you get the thrust that you need to travel through space. What's nice about it is you don't carry fuel. So even though the push of sunlight is very, very small, it's constant all the time. You can't turn off the sun. If the sun were to turn off, we'd have troubles a lot worse than trying to figure out how to get our solar sail to go from point A to point B. And so the figure of merit for being able to design a sail is low mass. Your listeners are probably familiar with Newton. Force equals mass times acceleration.
Uh-huh.
Well, when you're getting sunlight on your sail, there's a certain force on that sail. And depending on your mass, you get an acceleration. If your mass is low, you get a big acceleration. If your mass is big, you get a small one. And humans just are too heavy. No offense to anyone in particular, but all of us are too heavy. And the support equipment it takes to carry us, it's just going to be a long time before we have a sail big enough for that. So why do the scientists like it? What do they want to do with it? They want to use it to go to places that, with conventional rockets, you can't carry enough fuel to get there. And a destination that's of high interest to the science community is to put a spacecraft orbiting the sun over its north and south pole. If you look at the sun from the Earth, we're looking at the equator. We're 93 million miles away. The sun, you can put 105 Earths across its diameter. And that's huge. And we really have never studied in detail what's going on at the top because we can't see it. Or the bottom. We can't see either pole. There was a mission called Ulysses several years ago that flew over, went into a highly elliptical orbit, and they got brief glimpses of the poles, but no sustained observations. And the reason for that is because it would require a rocket that has four times as much energy as any rocket we've ever flown to directly insert a spacecraft into a polar orbit around the sun. But a solar sail that we could build today, we aren't building it yet, but we could take a spacecraft and over about 7 years raise its inclination up out of the ecliptic plane where we orbit the sun and be in that solar polar orbit and give us views of the sun that we've never had before to help us understand what it's all about. So I would say that's one of the biggest things that scientists are interested in the near term and using solar sails to go do.
So how durable is the sail? Because we always hear about really tiny micro objects hitting the shuttle, for example, or, you know, their windshield or hitting this or that and pitting things, you know, like a desert storm in Death Valley. So how durable is it? How often does that sail get hit and damaged?
Well, the sail will get hit a lot by little tiny dust grains. The thing that works in our favor, there are two things, is the sail is very, very thin, and these dust grains are moving very, very fast, 18 to 20-some kilometers per second, okay? they're traveling multiple miles per second. That's a lot of kinetic energy. So
right.
If you had a dust grain that hit a block of aluminum the size of a soda can, it would put a big dent in it, and it would be like a little explosion when it hit. In fact, it would blow a hole in it. And that's because the can is thick enough and there's enough mass there that it slows down and stops the dust particle, and all that energy of its motion, that motional energy gets turned into kinetic energy. Its kinetic energy gets turned into heat in that interaction. And anytime you have a lot of heat dissipated from a small volume, it's called a bomb. So it's like a bomb going off when it hits. Whereas the sail is very, very thin. And so this dust grain, the same dust grain that would blow up your soda can, hits the sail and doesn't lose much energy before it passes all the way through it. So the interaction, and we've tested this with hypervelocity impact, done some theoretical modeling, tested it. Basically, these dust grains just poke little teeny tiny holes in the sail, and over a 10-year mission, you might experience a fraction of a percent in area loss, hardly any at all. So we're really not worried about dust grains, but we'll get hit with them all the time.
So it doesn't put these teeny little holes in clusters, like if you look at a target range target where you've been shooting and the bullet keeps hitting the same thing, and all of a sudden you can't tell where the bullet entered or not, the whole area is blotted out with tears and rips and the hole.
There aren't that many of them, David. It turns out if you look at the spacecraft we send out, very few of them are taken out by interplanetary dust grains. They might get pitted on the solar panels because those are large area, but the density is very, very low. I mean, space is basically empty. And these are out there. There aren't enough of them to cluster like that. I mean, that's a good question. And I get that question a lot because people know about what the environment is out there and that these dust grains and micrometeors are out there. But there just aren't that many. And when they are, the likelihood of them all concentrating in one area is very, very small.
What's the life expectancy then of a solar sail?
As long as the mechanical systems and electronics keep functioning. For the Near Earth Asteroid Scout, which launches next year, we'll be flying a 6U CubeSat built by NASA JPL with a solar sail that we built here at NASA Marshall. And it's an 86-square-meter sail. So we're flying to an asteroid. We'll have about a 2.5-year cruise time. Got a camera on board, and we'll be doing science at the asteroid. But the limiter of the lifetime of the spacecraft will be how long it will take for the radiation to fry the electronics. It won't be a limit to the sail or the sail mechanical systems. It'll be before the brains of the spacecraft have just been out there too long, and the cumulative radiation dose causes damage in the electronics.
So you don't.
That's what we estimate will cause it to fail eventually.
So you don't radiation-proof the electronics, or that is with radiation-proofing?
That is what you can put into a small spacecraft.
Okay.
Remember that darn force equal mass times acceleration?
Uh-huh.
The best way to shield against radiation is to add mass. And for a sail system, mass is a bad thing. So you have to look and balance the mission life to do the mission you want to do versus how much extra mass you have to extend that mission life and what that does to your sail performance. So we did all those trades early in the design and figured out that most of the near-Earth asteroids that we were interested in surveying, which this is intended to do, are within about 2 to 3 years cruise time from the Earth. So when we picked the shielding out for the spacecraft electronics, we designed it so that we would be pretty certain we'd last at least 3 years so that we could do that survey. Maybe we'll get lucky and be able to last longer, but the limiter will probably be the electron.
Listener Jack is in Santa Fe, New Mexico, with an email, and he said, is there a NASA center that specializes in solar sail, or are all of them involved, or just Marshall?
Well, there are two primary centers for solar sail work right now, and that's NASA Marshall and NASA Langley. We're flying the Near Earth Asteroid Scout mission. NASA Langley has a composite boom demonstration that they'll be flying in the next couple of years that will deploy about a 70-square-meter solar sail in Earth orbit. And then our solar cruiser which we're in the final phase of either being selected or not. There are two candidates to fly two different missions that are vying for a ride in 2024. One is a sail, the one I'm leading. One is not, has nothing to do with sailing. And one of the two of us is going to get to fly, and we'll find out in December. So it's the work is not centered in just one location. Most of the work's going on at NASA Marshall, but not all of it. NASA Langley's making some good contributions.
Christine's in Salt Lake City, and she says, I'm actually a sailor, so this is probably really a dumb question, trying to apply sailing on water to a solar sail mission in space. But can you navigate by tacking and doing things like that with your sail?
Absolutely. It's not the same exactly as you would do with a keel and a rudder, but it's notionally similar. Think of a solar sail. The thrust from sunlight depends on the net force on the sail, and you can vary that direction by changing the angle with which the light reflects from the sail. So if you deploy your sail flat on to the sun, and if you weren't already in orbit around the sun, which we'll get to in just a minute, if you suddenly just popped a sail in space and it was not moving around the sun and it was just motionless, the sunlight pressure would be wanting to push it radially out from the sun. But everything we launch from Earth is in orbit. When we launch a rocket from Earth into space, it has Earth's orbital velocity with it, so it too is orbiting the sun. And so if you imagine in your head that you're looking down on the solar system and your sail is orbiting counterclockwise, and you deploy your sail such that the sunlight gives you a net thrust pushing you in the direction you're already moving, okay?
Uh-huh.
You increase your energy, so you spiral away from the sun. But if you tilt the sail so that you get a thrust from your sail that is in the direction opposite to what you're moving, so if the thrust is wanting to push you clockwise when you're moving counterclockwise, you'll slow down. And as you slow down, you lose energy, and the sun's gravity starts pulling you in. So that starts pulling you in toward the sun. And it turns out that because of the inverse square law, which is, it basically says that the intensity of sunlight on an object, if you double the distance, it doesn't just get cut in half, it gets cut to a fourth. I'm throwing a lot of math here, sorry. If you work the other direction and you cut the distance between you and the sun in half, you don't get twice the thrust, you get four times the thrust. It's a nonlinear relationship. So as you thrust opposite to the direction you're moving, you start falling toward the sun, and the thrust from the sun gets faster and it gets higher and higher very quickly. So it turns out a sail can actually sail toward the sun more efficiently than away from the sun, which is really counterintuitive. But what you have to do is tip and tilt the sail. And there is how you answer the question of your listener with tacking. And what you do to do that is, you either have onboard reaction wheels, which are basically spinning gyroscopes, and you alter the direction that they are spinning, and that torques the sail. But you can also, which is what we're going to be doing, is you move the sail in the XY, left and right, and you get a little bit more sunlight pressure on one side of the sail than the other, which causes it to tip or tilt. So you can move your spacecraft slightly relative, its position in the middle relative to this big sail, and you can get this big sail to tip or tilt the direction you want it to go. And that lets you control the angle that the light reflects from it and give you the thrust in the direction you want to go.
Paul sent in a note from Tucson, and he says, do you see solar sail having any application in the future for interstellar flights?
Absolutely. And I've looked at this. I've written books about this. In fact, I've got a book I'm writing for Princeton University Press on interstellar travels. It'll be out in about a year or so, year and a half. And I've looked a lot at how we might actually go to the stars. Early in my NASA career, I had the coolest job title I've ever had. This was about 20 years ago. I was NASA's manager for interstellar propulsion research and technology, and it was an experience. One of the things I learned is going to the stars is really, really hard. And that's an understatement. And if you look at the ways that known physics will allow us to do that, there aren't many. Getting the energy required to travel the distance to another star in a reasonable amount of time requires going to velocities which are really, really fast, and that takes a lot of energy. And if you try to do that with any kind of rocket, it's almost impossible. The closest we could come is something that has an onboard fusion power, which, by the way, we don't know how to do yet in big scale, let alone on a small spacecraft, but it's theoretically possible. Antimatter for the energy source, which, again, is theoretically possible. Antimatter is real. We know how to measure it. We don't know how to store it, but we can make minute amounts of it. But we'd have to have tons of it for an interstellar trip because you have to carry all that energy with you. Or you go off-board. And by off-board, I mean you get your acceleration not from fuel but from an external source. And that source could either be the sun or it could be a laser. So there have been methods proposed where you take a really, really big, very lightweight sail, fly very, very close to the sun, and get the speeds necessary to travel to another star. And then there's an approach that's being pursued by the Breakthrough Starshot folks, if you've heard of the Breakthrough Initiative.
Right, we've done a lot of programming on that, yeah.
I'm sorry?
We've done a lot of programming on that, so.
And so they would use a laser. I've been to several of their meetings and consulted a little bit on that project, and they've got some really good ideas. I'm optimistic. They've got big challenges, but they've got big ideas. So we'll get there. So the answer to the question is yes, you can. It's possible.
You have a caller who wants to talk to you, so you ready for this one?
I'm ready.
Hi, caller. Welcome to our program tonight. Who are you? Where are you? And thank you for calling. I think this is Marshall. Is that correct?
Yeah. And, gee, that means I don't need to do the Renfro thing, right?
That's right. You can leave Oklahoma out of it, although they so far have a winning football season with one game played. So go ahead.
Anyway, one of the problems with solar sails is, quote-unquote, the solar winds are not constant, and they're kind of like the ocean, can be real placid one minute and real blowout the next. If I may reference the September 1859 Carlington event, basically, wouldn't that kind of destroy any of the solar sail systems?
Well, what you're referencing about the variability of the solar wind is true. That the solar wind, though, are charged particles. That's typically protons and alpha particles, helium and such, streaming out from the sun. And then there are things called coronal mass ejections, where basically the sun burps and these massive flux of these charged particles come streaming out of the sun and give you that buffeting that you're talking about. But see, those are charged particles, and a solar sail isn't propelled by that. It's propelled by sunlight. And the sun's light is very, very constant. In fact, it's so constant that there's a term called the solar constant.
Mm-hmm.
And there's very little variability in the sun's emission of light, which is what propels the solar sail. Now, there is another propulsion system that I've dabbled on called an electric sail, which uses kilometer-long wires that have a voltage applied to them, positive voltage, that would reflect the solar wind that you're speaking of for propulsion, and they would experience that variability. I don't think that the solar wind ever gets so calm that they would be becalmed, ships on the ocean sometimes get caught in periods of no wind. They would just have periods of lower thrust than they would have with the active sun. So, yes, what you're talking about are very real phenomenon, very interesting things to consider for an electric sail, but they really won't affect a solar sail a whole lot.
Okay, I thought a solar sail was basically nothing much more than aluminum foil.
It is. It's very lightweight, reflective. It's a plastic is what we use today, a polyimide, a plastic that's pretty resistant to radiation. It's got 100 angstroms of aluminum on it. That's exactly right. And that the thing that makes it move is just reflecting the same old light that gives you a sunburn, or like me, gives me an unwanted sunburn on my head on a sunny day. As I'm out, I can't feel it, But that light's pushing on me. It's a very small push, but it is pushing on me. And it's that light reflecting from the sail which makes it move.
Okay, so any kind of a solar wind particle punches a hole through it? Or, how does a proton not hit anything and not affect it? Are you just assuming that it tunnels?
Well, what happens with the electrons, we can accumulate charge from electrons, and we have to manage that. We could differentially charge the sail. The protons basically just pass through, and they really don't lose much energy. There's a in radiation theory, there's this pattern of how radiation penetrates into matter and how it deposits its energy, and it's it deposits energy as a function of depth in the material. And it's because the sail is, again, so thin that these protons, in large part, just don't have any effect on the sail.
So basically the protons just tunnel through like it wasn't there, and the ones that actually accidentally hit a nucleus, I guess, bounce a little.
Some will just go right on through.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, that's something I didn't know. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Marshall, for your call.
Bye.
Listeners, you too can give us a call, 1-866-687-7223. Is there a maximum distance out in space from Earth or the Sun where a solar sail vehicle is okay, and then after that it's too far away?
Well, the answer to that's got a little bit of a nuance to it. If you want to continue accelerating far out into the solar system, the useful limit is really Jupiter. At about 5 astronomical units, that inverse square law means you have 1/25th the amount of light you have at the Earth, which means you've got about 4% the sunlight. So the thrust is way, way, way down. However, if you want to do a fast solar escape and you don't care to thrust all that way out and you want to get all your velocity close in, there is a mission that has been on the books to be considered for a long time, waiting on solar sails, in large part, to be able to do, called Interstellar Probe. And the idea is to use a solar sail that flies very, very close to the sun, where the sunlight pressure is very high. And it gives it a very high velocity. And then basically, by the time you get to Jupiter, you just throw away the sail, because it's not thrusting anymore, and you just coast. And theoretically, we could build sails that get spacecraft moving out of the solar system at speeds 4 and 5 times faster than Voyager. So it's not something we can build right now, but it is something that I think we could build in the not-too-distant future after some of these missions I've talked about have flown.
What would the cost be like compared to, say, what it costs to build Voyager?
The cost would primarily be in the spacecraft, not in the sail system. Solar sails are relatively inexpensive to build. The one for the Near-Earth Asteroid Scout that is flying next year, including all of the research that took to get it together, was under $3 million for the solar sail. The spacecraft itself and the whole mission is under $25 million. And that's a lot of money for you and me, but for a space mission, that's a pretty low-cost space mission.
And that includes the launch then, right?
Well, the launch, we cheat a little bit there. We've got a free ride to space. So that does not include the launch. That's just the cost of developing the spacecraft and the sail and the science instrument that will be
on. What is Near-Earth Asteroid Scout? What is that mission?
That's the one where we're flying the 86-square-meter solar sail attached to a small spacecraft that's got a camera. And we will be launching and flying by an asteroid. The actual asteroid is to be determined. Depends on when we actually launch. The launch date's a little bit uncertain. And we're going to study the asteroid, see what it's made of, learn a little bit about the neighborhood, and find out a little bit of history of the solar system.
Interesting. Could you send a solar sail mission to Venus to check out what's in the clouds now that people seem interested in it again?
Absolutely. A solar sail would be a great way to take spacecraft toward Venus. In fact, it would be a fantastic way to send a flotilla of small spacecraft to do all sorts of sampling there. There's no mission on the books to do that I'm aware of. Nobody's planning any such thing. but it would be a great candidate in the trade studies for the propulsion system that the spacecraft might use to get there.
I want to move us to your book. So my transition is, in science fiction literature, is there much written using solar sails, and is that becoming a popular vehicle for science fiction?
You know, I've been a science fiction, well, you don't know this, you don't know me that well, and your listeners certainly don't, but I've been a science fiction fan since I was a boy. It was Neil Armstrong when I was 7 years old, followed quickly by Star Trek, and then every science fiction book I could get my hands on that got me interested in studying physics and going to work for NASA. And there aren't that many stories, quite frankly. There's a famous one that was called Sunjammer, written by Arthur C. Clarke, appeared in Boys Life magazine back in the, I've got the magazine over here. Someone gave me a copy of it when I started working solar sails, but I can't remember the date on it. I could pull it out here in a minute and tell you. But it was about a basically a yacht race in space of solar sailing. And there have there's a great novel that was written when I was in college called A Mote in God's Eye by Larry Niven and Jerry Pournelle, which featured a breakthrough Starshot-type sail, laser-driven sailcraft coming toward Earth with aliens that were, I think, if I remember correctly, on their way to invade it. So not a good thing. But I haven't seen too many sails in science fiction. That's something I haven't seen a whole lot of.
Do you think that will start to change as sails become more prominent in actual missions?
I think it will. I think once they get into the consciousness, they'll take off. The Planetary Society did a lot with the flight of light sails. I mean, that Bill Nye, all over the place, people excited about sails. So, yeah, I do. And I think it's one of the methods that we'll see more and more of that. I do. I actually, surprise, surprise, in my novel, Mission to Methany, which you referenced earlier, it starts out with an asteroid mining company using CubeSat solar sail propelled spacecraft like the NEA Scout, like the Near Earth Asteroid Scout, to do low-cost surveys of asteroids, sort of like mineral assays, to see what resources are there that they could then exploit and sell to the burgeoning space industry that's happening back in cislunar space. So, yeah, I put it in my book. But no surprise, that would be something I'd write about.
Could you generate the light from the spacecraft to move it? Can you generate light and economically and also powerfully enough, or does it have to be from the sun?
It doesn't have to be from the sun. I would avoid putting anything on the sailcraft that makes it heavier, and you'd lose half your thrust by putting your laser on your sailcraft, because if just imagine you have your spacecraft and you're shining your light at your laser at you're shining your laser light at the sail, well, as you're shining your laser and it comes out of the front of the laser, you're getting a push the other direction, so you lose thrust immediately with the laser itself pushing itself backwards, and so you lose half the thrust of the sail. If a sail were black and absorbed the light, you would get the thrust of the photon hitting the sail. But because it's reflective, you get the thrust of the photon hitting the sail, and the photon reverses direction and comes back at you. So you get an equal push from the reflection, so you get twice the thrust that you would have of a absorptive sail. So if you put a laser on your sailcraft to push your own sail, you would only get half the thrust, because though you get the reflection, your laser would actually be giving you a thrust in the wrong direction at the same time. So it would be kind of inefficient. So I would think you'd want to put them off board, David. You'd want to have them somewhere else shining on your sail.
So your book, am I saying it right, Stellaris?
Stellaris.
Stellaris. So that actually just was recently released, correct?
Yeah, that's right. The paperback version came out in August, late August. So it's only been out a few weeks in paperback. The trade size came out a year ago. And, you know, blatant commercial, it's a thought about what's going to happen to us when we become an interstellar species. My co-editor, Rob Hansen, and I, he's a professor at Wake Forest College of Medicine, also a science fiction writer, we wanted to talk about something that we don't see a lot in science fiction. You know, we're having all these revolutions in biological science, cybernetics, genetic engineering, and we came to realize that one of the neglected topics when we discuss becoming an interstellar species is, what about us? Are we going to be the same as we are today? Will our biology, our physiology be the same? Will our cultural and political systems be the same? Or will they be different? And so we went out and canvassed and solicited original short stories from some big-name science fiction writers like Kevin Anderson, Todd McCaffrey, Sarah Hoyt, and others, to explore the topic of, you know, what's going to become of us. We're going to be different. There's no doubt we'll be different in a few hundred years when we start making these interstellar voyages. And how will we change, and how will we have to change? And then interspersed with that, we asked some scientists to write some nonfiction essays on that same topic about what they view the challenges of long-duration human spaceflight to be. We have the director of the NASA Human Spaceflight Program, former director. He's now moved on to Johns Hopkins University to teach. We even got Martin Rees, the astronomer royal in the UK, to give us an essay. So it's really trying to understand, what about us? So I think folks that are interested in topics like that, I think, would enjoy some of the stories and the essays.
Do we get genetically modified, or do we remain as humans here, or do we somehow become transhuman?
Well, I think it depends, right? As we are learning more and more about the exoplanets that are out there, it's becoming clear that there may be some that are in the habitable zone, but are they, in the Star Trek parlance, you know, class M planets, just Earth-like, where you beam down and you can breathe the air and eat the food and all that? It's highly unlikely, right?
Probably.
So,
yeah.
You know, even if there's liquid water, maybe there's an atmosphere. What's going to be in the atmosphere that could cause, you know, severe allergic reactions, even if it's really close to Earth-like? We have a story about basically alien protein. And how would your body's immune system react to that? And how would you modify it to survive that? So I think in some cases you would be looking at radical genetic engineering, and I think in other cases you might be looking at the $6 million man kind of physical body enhancement of people to get them to survive in long duration deep space flight. So it might be a mixture of that.
Does anyone think any of this is near term?
No.
What?
I go ahead. What?
Well, I was going to say maybe near term is not the correct word. If you were to have a timeline for this, when are we expected to be reaching a point where these become actually real laboratory-like decisions and you know, plans on making things to work that we have to really consider? I mean, are we 10 years out, 20 years out? What does anyone give an idea on that?
Well, I'd be hard-pressed to tell you when I think we'll actually mount a human expedition to another star. I think that might be centuries away. Sorry, younger listeners, you're not young enough. but I think we'll face some of these challenges if we actually set up if Elon Musk is successful and we end up setting up permanent human presence on Mars. I think we'll end up having to figure out perhaps how to genetically engineer to boost to decrease our sensitivity to cosmic rays and solar radiation, because the Martian atmosphere is not going to protect you like the Earth's atmosphere does. There's no magnetosphere. There's no deflector shield around it like our Earth magnetic field deflects a lot of the worst of the cosmic rays that your caller in was speaking of earlier. So I think that's an issue. I think the multiple year-round trips without gravity are going to be a significant problem for health of crew, and we may end up doing not necessarily genetic engineering but other kinds of body modifications in the future for that. I think all those things are on the table. So long before we go to the stars, as we become an interplanetary species, I have no doubt that we will adapt ourselves to those environments one way or the other.
This is an interesting question. So this is William in Miami. I don't know which Miami William is in. I don't know that that makes any difference. He said, I have not yet read your book, but I'm planning to. It sounds really interesting. I'm wondering if anyone who wrote an article or a story for the book, or even you, for example, believed that our travel outside of Earth to maybe Mars and maybe 300 or 400 years from now to the stars is inevitable, or can we really screw it up and never leave Earth?
Oh, I am an optimist and willfully believe that we will do it. Do I believe it's inevitable? I do not. All I have to do is look in my lifetime. I was born a year before the Cuban Missile Crisis, when we came really close to a nuclear holocaust, you know, right here, right now. A lot of your younger listeners may not remember the nightmares, David, that you and I had of 20,000 nuclear weapons being pointed at us from this country called the Soviet Union back in the day. Were we worried about nuclear Armageddon? Those fears are not prevalent today. That doesn't mean that that threat has gone away or it couldn't come back. So do I believe it is inevitable? No. Do I believe it is likely? Yeah, I do. I think we'll get through. We've gotten through before. We may have crises. We'll learn to overcome. And anything short of a complete holocaust will not deter us from going. But that said, things happen. I mean, just look at 2020. man, who would have predicted? And this was a relatively mild virus compared to some other things that are out there. So let alone what people have engineered in laboratories as part of chemical and biological weapons research, there are lots of things that could go wrong. So, no, I don't think it's inevitable. I would like to think that we will do it, though. I choose to be an optimist and look at the glass is half full.
Well, in keeping with this question that our listeners asked, Will, I was sent an article. I haven't mentioned this on the space show yet, and I'm kind of wondering, do I really want to ask the woman on the show? But grammar-wise, style of writing-wise, English-wise, this is really a well-written article. But this woman just makes the case that we have no business, no interest, no concern, no place in space, and then she just goes down Musk, goes down tourism, goes down this. This invention is really good because it came from space. She makes the case that it would come from someplace else. It's an exceptionally written article, and it reminds one that there are thoughtful people, intelligent people, who don't see in space anything close to what any of us see. I guess what I want to know is, could somehow that reality, I mean, you know, you see science fiction movies about alternate realities taking over, and something dark happens, and all of a sudden your reality is very different. Could something like that go viral? You probably haven't seen the article. I could send it to you.
I have.
Oh, you have?
No, I did. I read it in The Week.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's
it.
And I read her bio, and she has written in credible publications, and I thought her style of writing was really good. I enjoyed reading her article. I'm even tempted to invite her to be on the space show. Who knows if she'd come into this audience. But I could see a reality where that goes viral. Maybe not from The Week, and maybe not because of her, but, you know, in a world that's changing and people want different things maybe than what we want, I'm just wondering if we have to do something, if we need to be on guard, that kind of perspective could alter our going into the stars.
Well, it could. I mean, you just have to look at history at what happened to the great age of Chinese exploration, where they got an emperor who said, why are we wasting our time on this? Sink all the ships. And if they hadn't done that, North America would have been settled by, you know, Chinese people hundreds of years before Europeans got here.
Right.
So, you know, culturally, things can happen. My counter to that article was I looked up the value of dollars returned from the space infrastructure today, and that number is about $200 billion a year in revenue for just the U.S. economy from space. And so I immediately question the entire premise of her article that there's no value in it. If there's $200 billion of our economy just in the U.S. that are flowing from space activities, and I'm not talking about government space activities. I'm
right,
but
on a commercial
side. A
lot
of private commercial use of communication satellite, Earth remote sensing, resource monitoring, you use space satellites to find where oil reserves are, where mineral reserves are. People are making money hand over fist in space, and things are being invented all the time for the satellite industry that would not otherwise be invented because there's no incentive to do it for any other reason. So I just think the whole premise is flawed. But if you have a culture which passes laws to prohibit people like Jeff Bezos and Elon Musk, you could just completely smother the whole thing. I think that would be not just short-sighted, I think that would be almost malicious, in my opinion, for those kinds of laws to be passed, because I think that the people who are investing their personal fortunes to develop space are doing it for two reasons. One is to make money, which is, you know, a good capitalist economy that we are. That's a good thing. And I also think they're being somewhat altruistic and trying to make a better human future. And I certainly don't want to stifle that. So anyway, yes, I did read that article and thought about it. And I think she would be incredibly brave to come on your show.
Do you think I should give her a forum to put these ideas out there?
Absolutely. I am a big believer in the debate of ideas.
And so am I.
People I disagree with, you know, if you've got a good logical argument behind why you believe what you believe, I should hear you out because, darn it, you might be right and I could be wrong.
Well, we'll see see if she wants to come into the space show world, where probably every single person would disagree with her, but maybe she'd find that challenging. Do you have a favorite of the essays, both on the Martin Rees side as well as the science fiction side?
I do. There are two of the essays in the book, the nonfiction essays that I really, really that spoke to me. One was an essay by a fellow named Mike Massa.
I have that marked with a question to talk to you about. It's interesting that picked that.
That
chart on
implications of human culture.
Right, I have that chart on page 326 marked to talk to you about.
I can see why. That was an incredibly thought-provoking article, and in fact, it was based on that article. I chair the symposia for an organization called the Interstellar Research Group. And it used to be called the Tennessee Valley Interstellar Workshop, and it's called that on the book. In fact, the book is dedicated to them. And it's a group of space advocates, nonprofits, who are interested in facilitating the future of us going to the stars, knowing that it won't happen in our lifetimes. And we have meetings every 18 months to 2 years where people gather for 3 days. We recently were at Wichita State University in Kansas. And next fall, COVID permitting, we'll be in Tucson, and your listeners may be interested in attending. It's attended by scientists, engineers, space lawyers, sociologists, philosophers. We have philosophers from universities talking about the different things. We had Mike Massa come in at our meeting in Kansas and talk about this article because the the success of a long voyage in space may make the civil liberties that you sacrifice when you get on an airplane look like nothing compared to the freedoms you might have to give up in order to maintain order on a deep space voyage to keep everybody safe. I mean, it's a very thought-provoking article.
I hate to be ignorant, but who is Mike Moss? I'm not familiar with him, so tell us something about him.
Well, Mike is a security expert, and in one of his he knows a lot about this, and I think I'd hate to presuppose talking for Mike, but he thinks about things like this in his professional job for clients who worry about what might happen when they're in various places and how they might survive it.
Would he be good for the space show?
I think he'd be fascinating if he could. Yeah, he might. I think he'd enjoy it. I think I can put you in touch with him.
Yeah,
I'll send you his contact information.
Yeah, please do.
And make the introduction.
Yeah.
He's given a lot of thought to that topic.
You have another caller, so let me jump to and give the caller
a
line, okay?
Sure.
Hi, caller. You're on with Les and David. Who are you and where are you? Thank you very much for your call.
This is John in Fort Worth.
Hi there, John.
Yeah, I was on the idea on other planets and stuff. It seems to me that if you have a planet that's Earth-like, sufficient that people could try to live on it in an open-air environment, the problem is that the biosphere itself generates the oxygen environment for the most part, it would seem like, from on Earth, and that may be very typical. And when you try to bring an unshielded human being into a totally alien biosphere, it would seem like that would almost inevitably be problematic.
Oh, I agree. And in fact, my co-editor, Dr. Hansen, would agree with you completely, and that's why he believes we're going to end up probably having to tailor ourselves for the environment that we find.
Mm-hmm.
And just 20 years ago, we'd be scratching our heads and say, how do you do that when it takes so long just to sequence the DNA? But in the last 20 years, we've got CRISPR, which allows selective gene editing. There's the whole ethical conundrum of do you edit human genes? Right? This Chinese doctor who got in trouble for editing babies. So there's huge ethical implications to that. But I think you're right. I think the likelihood of us finding another biosphere that is human compatible without any modification is so small as to be zero.
That's my
opinion.
Yeah, I mean, if you had a plant that was literally dead that had an atmosphere of around 20%, plus or minus something oxygen and nothing toxic in it particularly, that would be ideal. But then of course you'd have to try to create soil with with the right kind of ingredients. I know that, remember, Heinlein wrote a book a long time ago called Farmer in the Sky, where he was talking about what would really be involved if you had a dead planet and trying to. He was using Ganymede, which in reality wouldn't work too well. But you know what I'm saying? Now, the concept there, what you'd have to do to create soil that you could grow plants in and a dead planet, what would be involved in that? It's kind of interesting.
It would be really, really difficult. You're exactly right. And I don't think any of us who are in the interstellar research group or in the interstellar advocacy community have any illusions that it's going to be easy or straightforward or that we're going to find, Star Trek-like habitable planets everywhere. It is possible that if and when we go, there'll primarily be purposes of seeking out other life and for scientific research and not necessarily settlement. We could probably, in our own solar system and in others, probably engineer our own habitat in space, sort of like Larry Niven's Ring World or something in the future, a lot easier than we could terraform another planet to be like Earth. I don't know. I mean, it's all so far away technologically, it's just speculation. But you're right. I think it would be really hard to imagine us just going and finding some place that we're compatible with. No, I don't think that's likely.
Yeah, I can remember I was about 13 when I first, this thought cropped in my head. I was on a school bus ride. I remember it was hitting me. I think it was partly motivated by the H.G. Wells' book, but I was thinking about Star Trek at the same time and going, oh, no. Anyway, it's an interesting subject we're discussing. I know on a modified human stuff, I know Alistair Reynolds has written a whole bunch of books, like the Revelation Space series, where he has creatures in there that have all kind of modifications to their bodies and stuff, implants and every kind of thing like that.
Hey, Les,
yes.
I haven't read the entire book yet, but among these authors, or maybe yourself included, the likelihood of there being sentient life someplace out there, high likelihood, non-existent, never visited Earth. What do you think?
Wow. I have an essay that I'll refer your listeners to that's free. It's on my publisher's website, Baen Books, BAEN.com,
uh-huh.
And it's called The Aliens Are Not Among Us. And it's my view of why I don't believe, I'm going to get people upset at me, I don't believe we're being visited by aliens, nor do I believe we have been any time recently. Because I think the likelihood of two intelligent tool-using civilizations existing in the same time frame, close enough that they could interact with each other, is just so minutely small as to be almost zero. And I can hear, you know, people going ballistic.
Yeah, John
already
is probably
disagreeing
going,
with me.
Yeah, probably John is still on the phone. He's going ballistic and holding his temper. But
so the answer is, my opinion, I think it's inevitable. I think there is other life out there somewhere. Absolutely. Do I think there's some extent right now while we are a technological civilization? Maybe. I think it is far more likely if we were ever visited or had a chance to be visited that it would have happened during the reign of the dinosaurs, who were around for tens of millions of years, than during the reign of humans, which have been around in the hundreds of thousands, maybe. So just looking at probabilities, if they are out there, it is very unlikely that we will encounter them at all, in my opinion.
So UFOs you don't believe in, then?
No. And I know that there's a lot of buzz about these Navy sightings, and I will not pretend to be an expert at being able to look at that video footage of the Navy pilots trying to chase down this flying saucer and tell you what that is. I just will say that I'll be highly surprised if the conclusion is it's extraterrestrial. I would love for it to be. Don't get me wrong. I think that would be awesome. Maybe. But I'm just very skeptical. I need the evidence, and we need to have a lot of it.
John, you want to comment about any of that?
Well, all I can say is it seems to me that there's an extensive amount of instances. That's just one of the highlight instances. This thing has been going on a long time, and it's hard to know. I mean, it just seems to me that all the sightings and things that have occurred can really be coincidental. On the other hand, I can understand from the known laws of physics, this should not be happening. I guess that's the viewpoint I have on it. I understand fully why it shouldn't be happening, because it would mean that something would be violating the known laws of physics in areas which we think we have a pretty good handle on. You know, and that's...
Well,
would seem unlikely, but if it is happening, then, you know.
I'm not going to dispute the evidence. I mean, if the evidence comes forward and says, look at this, and, you know, because of A, B, C, D, E, and F, here you go, I'll be convinced. I'll tell you right now, I'll be the first to say I was wrong.
So we'll just have to wait and see what happens. I mean, the thing is, there are claims that people really know the answer to it and have been keeping it from us. At the same time, I understand the implausibility of how could you keep a secret like that.
It's just one of those ongoing things. I work for the government. It's really hard to conceive of how things can be kept secret for long. You've always got people like Snowden that are out there, and Chelsea Manning and others, right? And so something like that I'm with you. I think it'd be really hard to keep that a secret for very long.
Yeah, on the other hand, if it's really happening, you see, that's the whole thing. And it just seems to me it's on the other hand, when you look at some of the reported incidents, I mean, you know, there are some, most of them you can ignore, but there's some that are so strong, just that they're going, you know, how many people saw what, you know? I mean, if you look at something like the Hudson Valley UFO incidents back in the 80s, they're going, it seems kind of incredible, but, you know.
I would encourage your listeners. There's a book. I'm going to give a plug for a book that's not mine. There's a book, a biography I found on a used book table somewhere, and it's the biography of the astronomer and flying saucer researcher J. Allen Hynek.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Back in the 50s, 60s, 70s,
yeah,
in the 80s.
Blue Book.
All this.
Yeah, Blue
and,
Book.
And yeah, Blue Book guy. And it's not his book. It's a book about him and his quest and his integrity and interviews with his family and his personal records. And it's a very well written book that gives you insight into somebody who approached it with a skeptical eye. And came away convinced there might be something there.
Do you remember the actual name of the book?
No.
Or the author?
I've got it on my shelves in here, but I've got about 900 books staring at me. I don't remember the name of the book. I'm sorry. I wasn't expecting to talk about it this evening.
Okay.
But it's a biography of J. Allen Hynek. Really, really well done.
Maybe it's the only one, and we can find it.
Yeah.
John, do you have anything else for our guest tonight?
I think that'll be it for now. Very interesting discussion.
Thank you very much, John. Listeners, you too can give us a call. There is still time. 1-866-687-7223. And email, of course, you can continue to use drspace, D-R-S-P-A-C-E, at thespaceshow.com. Where should we be putting our human spaceflight resources to maximize being able to get out to the stars someday? Are we doing the right things? Are we incrementally, you know, going along kind of baby steps along the way? Are we on the right track, or are we somehow off track?
Well, you know, David, this is one I probably ought not answer given who my employer is, because I really can't comment on, like, you know, policy issues with regard to that. What I can tell you is that, in my opinion, we need to make sure that whatever we do in space provides clear and present benefit that people understand why we're doing it. And I think in a lot of cases that's obvious, if not necessarily to the person who wrote that article in The Week. But when we talk about these kinds of explorations and robotic or human, there needs to be a really clearly articulated reason we're doing it and what the benefit is and why it's important. And I think that once you have to go through the logic of doing that, then you're going to come up with a solid plan that gets you moving in the right direction.
Well,
I think it's when we make decisions that are not based on those kinds of thinking that we start projects or otherwise that don't come to completion because they just can't be sustained and supported.
So I'm thinking of efforts for space settlement, which are largely private sector commercial kind of efforts to the degree that they're going on. Are we ready for that? Should we be pushing forward on that, or do we need to do some things that would be better to prepare us for space settlement that we're not doing yet?
Well, I mean, to me, one of the things I'm excited about, and you mentioned commercial space early on, which is not, this is not something that's in the realm of what, you know, your taxpayer-funded space exploration does or necessarily should do.
Right.
And that is this whole notion of hotels in orbit, space tourism, medical facilities, that kind of thing. I think that's the kind of thing that's going to take us to space settled. Government programs to invest in technology and to develop the capabilities, which are used for exploration, and then industry comes along and uses to for profit or to send more people out, is the right approach, in my opinion. And so the answer to your question is, yeah, I think a lot of things we're doing are the right thing. The life support systems that have been tested on space station are really darn efficient and can be picked up by commercial users easily and transferred over there. I think that what we learned about how to mitigate the effects of zero gravity is immediately applicable to anybody who wants to settle space and take people out there. I think the low-cost launch that's being pioneered by these private companies to compete with the established aerospace companies is going to help along the way. It's the right thing to be doing. So, yeah, I think we're doing a lot of things right. I really do.
You got another caller. Can you continue with us for a few more minutes?
Sure.
You're with? Okay. Hi, caller. Welcome to our program. Who are you? Where are you? Thank you for calling.
Oh, hi, David. This is AJ Kotari.
Hi, AJ. Good to hear from you again.
Yeah, it's been nice talking with you. Thank you very much. Very interesting talk there. My question is, you mentioned that the chances of two civilizations or even more meeting each other at the same time when they have progressed to the level that we have, for example, within that time frame compared to the time frame of the amount of time that the Earth has been alive or solar system has been around is very small, and so that's almost close to zero. But what about the time that, not this time, but the time interval, if you were to also say that, okay, this civilization is not going to die, but we'll live on for another several billion years or 4 billion years. And we are sort of new at this technology. But isn't it possible that some other intersection of that type would take place? And that would be much more likely. That's my first question. The second question I'll ask later.
As far as more likely, I don't know, because we've only got one data point, unfortunately, right? But I think it is certainly possible.
I mean, we have one data point, but I mean, we have so 4.5 billion years of history behind us, but probably another 4.5 billion years of Earth's existence ahead of us. So we do have that kind of an idea.
We do, and one of the things that I have to admit, when I look at the results of the so far fruitless search for extraterrestrial intelligence, and our scans of the sky looking for the black body curve that might be a Dyson sphere out there or something, we haven't seen any of that. And all that we see when we look out, it sure looks like it's empty. I have to admit, part of me wonders if we might not be among the first.
Yeah.
And in science fiction novels, there used to be a very common theme that this young humanity goes out to the stars and finds out that they're newcomers and there are, you know, the elder races that have been out there for 20,000, 100,000, a million years in space. Given what we know about stellar evolution and how long it takes to get to heavy elements, and the fact that first-generation stars were all hydrogen and you didn't have all the heavy elements that make chemistry and life possible until after you get into second-generation stars. This is a lot of stellar astrophysics stuff. But the bottom line is that it could very well be that all these other things have to come to pass before you have the chemistry and the environment and the time for life to happen, to occur from an evolutionary point of view. And maybe we're the elder race. And we're just getting started.
Well, maybe, but we are the supposedly the Big Bang occurred, what, 15, 16 billion years ago, and the universe has been, solar system has been around for about twice our age. So there is still a lot of possibility of a large section, chunk of time, isn't there?
Oh, absolutely. And I think deep time is underestimated. Just like we can't, I know that the sun is 93 million miles away. Experientially, I have no clue what it means to be 93 million miles away from something, right? That's just beyond my human experience. And so when we hear stories about the Permian extinction 200 and some million years ago, I have no idea what the passage of time of 200 million years, that's just unfathomable to me, right?
Yeah.
And so when you're talking about these incredible timescales, I would be the first to say that anything is possible, right? I don't know everything, and it's entirely possible. And I would love to believe there's other life out there, and I'd love to believe we can make contact with it. The thing is, if they're a million years ahead of us,
why haven't they contacted us or something like that, I guess.
Well, and, you know, the ants might be asking, well, why haven't they contacted us, right? Because it might be that the difference in what they are and what we are is so great that they may not even notice we're here, quite frankly, or that we're inconsequential. In the scheme of things, I have no idea what that would be like. Oh, it's fun to think about, though. That's why I love science. That's why I write it. I want my mind to think those deep thoughts.
They may be contacting us through some other means than electromagnetic waves or something else.
Well, I'm waiting for them to call into a space show program. But I've been waiting.
Well, my favorite thing to say is, you know, maybe they're wondering why we're not listening on, you know, modulated tachyons. Right.
You know, I've been waiting.
And the answer is, well, are those, were they theoretically possible? Are they real? We just don't know how to detect them or generate them. And once we do, we tap into the galactic internet, right?
Well, or would we even believe it?
Who knows?
Would we even believe it if they tapped into it? So that's another issue.
Or the dark matter of 95% of the universe being, you know, dark matter or whatever it is.
What's your number two item, AJ?
Number two item was, you mentioned something about going to Venus, sending probes to Venus with solar sails. And how can we possibly do that if the solar photons are coming from, you know, solar-centric side to an outside? So how can we be able to do that?
Well, I probably didn't do a good job explaining it, but I tried to explain that earlier in the call.
Okay.
Where I talk about all of the objects in the solar system being in orbit around the sun. And when you're already moving, if you use the sail to slow down, the sun's gravity pulls you toward the sun, and so you can fall into the sun. And the sunlight gets brighter faster as you move toward the sun, so your thrust goes up from sunlight, so you get more and more efficient at slowing down and falling into the sun. So just think about everything being in motion. If we weren't in orbit and already moving really fast, you'd be correct. But because we're moving, you can use a sail to slow down, and then the gravity will pull you in.
Right.
So,
the only reason
the Earth doesn't fall into the sun is because we have enough orbital energy that Newton's laws help us to counteract that pull through our energy of motion around our star.
Or some
other. And if we were to slow down, we would fall in toward the sun.
Some other aliens provided us that energy, you know, many billions of years ago, I suppose.
Hey, I'm not going there.
and I think that, David, I probably should hang up. So
okay.
The alien can call.
Thank you, AJ. Appreciate your call. Listeners, we're coming toward the end of our program. If you would like to get a call in, we're certainly here to take your call, 1-866-687-7223, and email drspace@thespaceshow.com. Of all the things you wanted to discuss tonight, have we forgotten to discuss something, omitted something, left it out? Do you want to add something more?
Well, David, if you haven't figured it out by now, I love talking about space and space topics, and I've just really enjoyed a lot of your listener comments. They've been very thoughtful, good questions. I will, if I can give some information, I'll do that myself. You can get my website. It's lesjohnsonauthor.com, all one word, lesjohnsonauthor.com. I'm also on Facebook, Les Johnson Author. I try to be consistent, if nothing else, right?
Right.
And I'm on LinkedIn, not as much on LinkedIn, but I am on LinkedIn at Les Johnson, number one. Just Les Johnson 1, so you can find me there. Also, we'd love to hear from folks. My email is Les, L-E-S dot M-A-I-L, Les dot mail at lesjohnsonauthor.com. And primarily, just I hope you've enjoyed it. If you do, check out my books. I've got both popular science and science fiction books out there from Bayon Books and from Springer. Got a whole book on solar sailing that I wrote a few years ago that was actually reviewed in the journal Nature, got quite a bit good review and sold very well. You'll learn a lot about solar sails if you
What is your next book coming out? What are you working on now, and what's next?
Well, I've got a couple of books in the works. I've got a new novel with one of my favorite co-authors, Travis Taylor. It's called Saving Proxima, and it's a novel of first contact, and it'll be out next year from Bayon Books. I just got to see the cover art for the book from the artist was sent to me this week, and it's beautiful. It's just gorgeous. And I'm working on my next solo novel, which is not a sequel to anything. It's a standalone book, and it's called Displaced. And it's also a novel of first contact, more of a space opera than a first contact novel. And I've got a nonfiction book that I mentioned earlier that I'm writing for Princeton University Press about interstellar travel. So I've got quite a few things in the work. And by the way, I have to let your listeners know I do all this on my own time, not in connection with my day job. NASA doesn't endorse or support my writing. It takes me about a year to write a book, and I do it on weekends and evenings when I'm not being interviewed on the space show.
Well, you need to let me know when these books are close to market and or publication, and I'd love to have you come back on and talk about them and talk about other topics. It's a lot of fun talking with you. I've forgotten about that, and you've refreshed my memory from programs in the past, and so you need to come on much more regularly.
Well, thanks, David. I appreciate that. You better be careful. I'll take you up on it.
Well, I'll turn to you for first contact, and you know, who knows, maybe we'll get a break, and they'll decide we need some. You know, everyone's looking to them to come and help us with solving all of our crappy problems. So I'm not holding my breath, but you know, anything can happen. I guess I could even win the lottery. So. We'll see. We'll see about all of that. One more question came in for email, and this will probably get us going for another 10 minutes. But Todd in San Diego says, before you go, can you please express your thoughts on planetary protection and bringing samples back from Mars? And do we need to be concerned about either contaminating Mars or someplace else with Earth products or Earth microbes, and do we need to be worried to the extent of whatever we do with sample returns, like from Mars, bringing back Andromeda strain to Earth? Your thoughts, please.
Yeah, the first thing I thought of when I heard the question was the movie The Andromeda Strain, Michael Crichton.
Right.
I haven't read the book, but I saw the movie, right? Who in our generation didn't have nightmares after seeing that movie? Wow, good question. There is no doubt that anywhere people go, either personally or with our robots, no matter how hard we try, there is a good chance that our microbes are going with. Okay?
Right.
And we are finding that some of those microbes will survive just about anything, including radiation of space. I mean, there are microbes living on nuclear reactors, for heaven's sake. So there is, you know, the only choice we're going to have if we want to have zero risk of us contaminating the destinations we visit is to not visit. And I don't view that as a viable thing. So that said, I think we need to do everything we can to be responsible and not pollute or contaminate potential places where we might find life when we go. And the good thing is, if we do find life, the chances of it being similar enough to Earth life that we would confuse the two are almost zero. So let's say we go to Mars and we send people and they inevitably bring their microbes and we're digging around on Mars and we find what we think is extant Mars life. It would probably be so different than anything like Earth life that we would know immediately it wasn't something we brought with, right?
Right.
Do we worry about our microbes altering that Martian environment? Well, there's probably a chance, but not enough that I'd really personally worry about. But then again, I'm not a planetary science expert, and I'd probably have people, you know, on that side coming out of their chairs at the thought of us sending people because we would inevitably bring our microbes with. Now, in terms of reverse contamination and bringing things back here, I want to be pretty careful. I think I'd want to make sure that there was really no chance of a container breaking and any samples we bring back coming out and contaminating the environment here. Now, that said, you have to remember that we get tons of meteoritic dust added to the Earth every year from space. Okay?
Right.
There are meteorites constantly hitting the Earth. Meteorite hunters love going to Antarctica because you can see them. They stand out. In the jungles, you can't see them. It's just another rock. But when you're on the ice and you see a black rock sitting on the top of the ice, you have a pretty good clue. This came here from somewhere. Where could it have come from? Right?
Right.
A lot of times those are meteorites. So we are getting pelted by samples from other places all the time. All the time. And so, you know, is it any more risky to bring back a rock than it is just, you know, existing and having these things pelt us all the time? I'm not an expert enough to give that answer. But I would say if we take the proper precautions and use good common sense, it ought to be okay to do. And I think it's probably worth what little risk there is to find out if there is life in other places. That's my opinion.
Well, I think quite a few people share that with you, but quite a few people really believe in lockdowns on planetary protection. So I've never taken a poll, but I think there's a probably split almost equally among space show audience. And I think COVID has really taken some people over to the side of being ultra, ultra conservative about that. So...
Yeah, I'm not enough of a virologist or otherwise to really give an opinion on the likelihood of the cross contamination being a pathogen. You know, I would have no idea. That's a good question.
Well, Michael Crichton's book is better than the movie, so if you want to really get the get the full extent of Andromeda strain, read the book. but the movie was also exceptional. And, you know, Andromeda becomes one with the Milky Way at some point, right? Way down the road.
Way down the road.
Way down the road.
Yep.
So if there is an Andromeda strain, we're going to merge with it anyway, right?
Well, yeah. How many billion years are we talking about? A long time.
Well, it'd be a long time. But, you know, Earth cooties are going to become one with Andromeda's crew cooties, you know, a billion years from now. So we might as well get used to it.
Well, I'd like to think, going back to the question that was asked earlier, you know, is it inevitable that we will become an interstellar species? I would like to think that, yes, we will, and that in a billion years, you might be right, that we might have gone enough places in our own galaxy that we could make that leap to another galaxy. So, yeah, give me a billion years. Let's do it.
Well, hopefully your library of books and my MP3s will exist and people will know that this conversation happened a billion years earlier.
Yeah, let's hope.
Les, it's really a pleasure to reconnect with you and have you back on the Space Show. And I love your work and your shows, and I look forward to talking to you in the near future. Keep me posted, okay?
I'll sure do it. You take care and be safe.
You too, and appreciate your time tonight. Listeners, that's it with Dr. Les Johnson. And come back for all the rest of the programming this week. So I want to thank all of you who called. And good night from Les and David and the Space Show. And as we'd like to say, everybody, be safe and keep looking up.